This is Steve Stillwell. Welcome to the Ouachita Bushcraft and Survival Show. Today, we have a special guest, Cody Lundeen. If you're not familiar with him, he was one of the featured survivalists on Dual Survival, which aired on the Discovery Channel. He has a couple of books to his credit. In fact, I ordered one of them today, 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive. He has another book, When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes. He's been featured in numerous magazines, interviews, etc. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome Cody Lundeen to our show. Welcome to the show, Cody. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
You have come to this program with rave reviews from a mutual friend.
Well, we'll see what you think after the interview's over.
Oh, I know it's going to be good. I've been a fan of yours a long time, and I practice survival skills myself. You know what you're talking about. That's why I invited you to be on our show today. And I have a question for you, okay? This is probably one of the most important questions. When you first started practicing survival skills, did you ever think it'd take you this far? Did you ever think you'd wind up on television?
That's not why I started doing this, of course, but yeah, it's been quite an event. You know, I don't even know how to answer that question because I've been doing this for so long that, you know, it wasn't even cool, quote unquote, to do this stuff. You know, there was no shows on television. It was more or less media pieces about news pieces.
Yes.
The TV, you know, like when they were actually gave a damn about the facts and, you know, how do you survive in the desert? It was really kind of cut and dried news pieces that were the thing back then. But now it's all, you know, mostly sensationalized garbage.
Yeah. It is. And in fact, that's what kind of drew me to like your show. I've been practicing these things for some time, too. And like you said, they weren't cool. But I started off as a hunter, and I realized if I'm going to venture into some dangerous places, some remote places, I need to know what the heck I'm doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, heck, in this day and age, now what we do is kind of cool. It's kind of popular. But I could tell that you do these things because you love them. And that's why I like what you do.
Well, thanks.
Yes, sir. Now, another thing I'd like to talk about, and you've been asked this probably a million times, is let's talk about you going barefoot. I've got a best friend down in Texas, a guy named Key Anderson, and I'll tell you what, he's gone barefoot ever since we were in high school together. Got the toughest feet, but he's got the healthiest looking feet I've ever seen. He does his exercises. He'll go walk several miles a whole way barefoot. So let's talk about that, how it makes you close to nature and your philosophy there, Cody.
Sure, and that's been asked many, many times, as you can imagine. It wasn't a conscious decision to go barefoot by going barefoot. And what I mean by that is I just always wondered about indigenous people all over the world. You know, yes, people made foot gear. They made sandals. They made moccasins, whatever. But they primarily went barefoot when they could. And the reason for that, if you ever made a pair of shoes, is pretty practical. It takes resources, and it takes a lot of time to make footwear.
Yes, sir,
it does. And so that footwear was saved. It was saved for when you needed it. And if you're around camp or whatever, there's really no need for that to actually use a resource. It's called wasteful. And that's kind of what we're not used to that word anymore, especially in this country. But indigenous people or anyone who knows where resources come from and how hard they are to get, you know, it's not going to do things they don't need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So my first thing was about knowing that indigenous peoples largely went barefoot. Why didn't I? At least I could experiment with that and see how that worked for me. The other reason, there's all this grounding and earthing stuff out there now, and that wasn't the case a long time ago, because I've been going barefoot for quite some time. But it was just a way to move slower, to be more careful out in the backcountry. I do enjoy it. It makes you pay attention. And the other aspect of that that I found fascinating, because I teach survival skills professionally, I like to read a lot of real survival stories. And some of the ones that are the most harrowing are from POW,
mm-hmm.
you know, from our military personnel that have been caught. And one of the first things that the enemy, quote unquote, did was took their footwear, because no one's going to run away without their boots, because their feet are not conditioned to do that. And so wanting to do more with less and being self-reliant in general, it made a lot of sense to not have to be a slave to one piece of gear where it could just check someone out and it's game over.
I love that philosophy, Cody.
Well, it's not for everyone, clearly,
yeah.
But I have had people contact me that went barefoot after seeing me do X, Y, and Z. And the cool thing about that is that several of these people had foot problems that started to self-correct after they did start going barefoot. And I'm not talking about walking around the deserts and the mountains. I'm talking about just take your shoes off in your house
mm-hmm.
or around the yard or something like that, and their foot problems started to improve. which is pretty interesting.
Very great information. I never took that into consideration about the POWs.
Yeah, and that's common. If you read a lot of those stories, I mean, boom, off went the boot.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures, and I just, you know what, I never made the connection. Let's talk about gear, because one thing, you specialize in desert survival. I've seen you go out on some of the programs with just the clothes on your back. Let's talk about some essential gear that you might recommend for, say, a beginner or a novice, somebody maybe venturing into the desert the first time. What should they carry?
And to quantify your statement, I mean, Arizona is very diverse. I mean, I do mountain survival, teach winter survival, and desert survival all in the same state. So Arizona has more geographical diversity in the shortest drive time of any place to North America.
Cool.
California has more. So it is cool. It's very cool, and it's one of the reasons I'm here, but it also can kill you.
Yes.
So what I mean by that is the gear that we might talk about is obviously geospecific. You need to know the environment you're going into.
Absolutely.
But the gear that I tend to have to carry needs to be good for desert, and it needs to be good for mountains, because we're playing with both.
Yes.
And they might be an hour drive apart.
Yes.
So to answer your question, you wanted to talk about desert, and so we'll do that. Again, the gear is really specific to the context of the situation, but when you say desert, I can narrow it down to it's too damn hot, right? Because that's the biggest killer is hyperthermia. So what hyperthermia is, for your listeners that don't know, it's a rise in core body temperature, which is typically 98.6 degrees. So when someone's in a hot environment, they can gain heat from that environment. It's called hyperthermia.
Mm-hmm.
Hyper meaning high, thermia meaning heat. It's from the Greek origin. And that's bad. And that's what kills the most people in the outdoors. In the desert is lack of thermoregulation. It's not rattlesnakes and scorpions, you know, it's their core body temperature got too hot.
Yes, sir.
So as far as gear, the question that you're referencing, ironically, some of the best gear you can have in the desert is what in the hell are you wearing for clothing?
Mm-hmm.
Because clothing is the easiest way, the most gross motor movement way to try to mitigate too much external environmental heat from soaking into the body's core. Clothing also does another thing. We can go down the rabbit hole, and I love doing that. But
yeah.
I also want to make it pertinent for people in your state. I don't imagine there's a hell of a lot of desert where you're at.
No, it's wooded terrain and very, very mountainous, a lot of rocks, clear streams. But
right, and we can talk about that maybe later.
Sure,
but the other thing that clothing does, it helps to regulate core body temperature, mainly by protecting the body from the sun, right? It shades the body. The other thing it does is helps the body to mitigate its sweat loss. What I mean by that is here, unlike where you are in the summertime, it's very dry. It's a dry heat. The clothing allows the sweat to evaporate at a slower rate on the skin, and that increases survival time.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't sound sexy, and it's not like I'm trying to sell stuff, because I never have, because there's a lot of BS about gear. A lot of gear caters to people's ego. It caters to people's ignorance. It caters to people's wallet, so the people that are making it.
Yeah.
And there's very little practicality to a lot of gear that's out there. So going into the desert dressed like me is not what you want to do. You know, I'm the anomaly with shorts and barefoot, and you don't want to do that.
Sure.
You want to cover up your skin, you know, like the Bedouins in the Middle East. They're not walking around with a tank top and shorts and flip-flops. You know, they have full clothing with those robes that are performing a function of physiology to try to keep that core body temperature at 98.6 degrees.
Speaking of 98.6 degrees, I ordered your book off of Amazon today.
I remember arguing with my publisher. That book has very little things in it that are time dated.
Yes.
I did not go and try to sell crap gear that you don't need. I tried to keep it to where you could go into a mom and pop store in Arkansas and buy some of this stuff with few exceptions. And you'll notice when you get the book, there's a heavy focus on clothing, like we're talking about now. So, and it's physiology, physics, and psychology. Those are the three P's, by the way. To anyone who claims to teach survival skills, they should have a knowledge of physics, heat loss and gain, like we're talking about. They should have a knowledge of physiology, because we're trying to keep the human body alive. If you have a survival instructor that doesn't understand basic physiology, that's like getting your car fixed by someone who doesn't understand an engine. And then, of course, the psychology of people when they're scared, because that's the biggest aspect of survival situations that's largely ignored, is how people's mental and emotional attitudes change when people are freaked out.
Fear is a paralyzing factor. I know that, Cody. I've worked in law enforcement. I've been in the military, too.
And they can either freeze up or they can panic and run away.
Yes,
or
sir.
Anything in between.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lundeen here, he specializes in desert survival. And Cody, I'll fill you in here. We have a lot of hunters here who travel to different regions like New Mexico, Colorado. Some of them go out west of Utah. I was in West Texas last year in the desert there, and it's a unique environment. I love it and can't wait to go back. But one thing I was told by one of our mutual friends, before you take your students out, you had them hydrate, I mean big time. You had them drink a certain amount of water. Let's talk about that a little bit, hydration.
Sure. You know, I don't want to bum your viewers out by always talking about the desert, right? So hydration is just as critical in your part of the country.
Absolutely.
You know, as it is out here.
Yes, sir.
What I do for my clients in the field is I'm assuming, you know, most people are dehydrated in America just walking around. You can tell hydration in a human body primarily by the color of someone's pee.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pee is yellow, that means metabolically that the body could actually use more water. Now, the problem with colored pee in America is most people are popping multivitamins. I don't have an issue with that, but B vitamins especially color urine. So let's say you're going out on a hunt, right, and you know water is heavy. It's 8.4 pounds a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's over 2 pounds a quart. And that's a lot of water weight, period, because you're carrying other stuff on a hunt. If you prehydrate and drink a quart or two or whatever before you go out, you still want to obviously carry your water. You want to carry the water in your body primarily. It doesn't do any good in the canteen if you're too scared, stupid to drink it. And that's happened as well.
Yeah.
So what I do on my courses, we're going to head into the backcountry because we teach in wilderness. We don't just teach in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And before we go out, I'm assuming people are dehydrated. I have them drink at least one U.S. quart or European liter of water, maybe two, depending on how big the person is, etc. On some courses, I'll drink four. I'll drink a gallon of water over a period of about like 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go and do our thing. And of course, we fill up our water bottles from the jerry cans on the van. Now, context is important because context will get you killed quickly in this profession. So I want to be clear with the people that are listening to your show that we're hydrating at a van with jerry cans. You know, there's no reason to ration water, which is a whole other can of worms, in this context. Because we're bringing the water as part of the school because it's my responsibility. We're having the students pre-hydrate and filling up the water bottles from our jerry cans on the van before they leave that known water source. So this isn't, you know, the reason we do that is obvious if you've taught for 30 years.
Yes.
Is because people will function better. They feel like crap about the first 15 or 20 minutes because they might feel nauseous. If they throw up, that's too much water. Obviously, mm-hmm. they drink too much. That's very rare for that to happen. But they usually feel crummy, and that goes away in about 15, 20 minutes, feeling slightly nauseous. So what I know with that student now who's drunk that water, I know we're all on the same page. I'm way into baseline. I know my client has showed up in whatever state of stress. They either slept good or they didn't. They either ate good or they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
At least I know they haven't been in the field because we just showed up for the course.
Yes.
I'm assuming they're dehydrated. So I want to eliminate those variables, which is what kills people
mm-hmm.
in the backcountry. And hydration is a big one. That's why we're talking about it. And so I have them pre-hydrate in that context, and then we go out into the wilderness and start our training.
That's great, Cody. In fact, I've heard some really good things about your school, that you really care about your students. And something like that, you can't hide. You can't bluff. Ladies and gentlemen, this man is genuine. And again, that's why I had him on the show.
Yeah. Imagine teaching survival skills and not caring about your students.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
You know, we're teaching people, it's a very sacred trust when you think about it. And you said you've had the military and law enforcement experience, and I'm assuming there's a certain brother and sisterhood.
Sure.
When you're in tight conditions where you have to trust the person next to you
mm-hmm.
in extreme circumstances.
It's life
and
death.
The same way with us.
Sure.
Correct. And so our clients, our students, they're trusting me, you know, and my co-instructors literally with their life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sacred trust where I have zero tolerance
Absolutely.
For lies, deceit, and I just have no tolerance for bullshit in this field.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that you're dealing with people's safety and you're dealing with their life. Period.
I agree, Cody. Let's talk about some purification methods real quick. What's your favorite purification method for water?
Okay, let's talk about the herbology first. Purification, okay. I'm assuming you mean disinfection. So water purification means how water looks and smells. I'm assuming you mean disinfection, which is destroying waterborne pathogens that get people sick.
Yes, sir.
So you'll see even on tablets, it says water purification. That's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
For your listeners. So water disinfection techniques, and there are several. What we use the most on courses is tincture of iodine 2%. And there's some contraindications. There's three of them. Contraindications is a fancy word meaning don't do it. If you have a known allergy to iodine, or if you're pregnant or have a thyroid issue, when we have a client that might have a thyroid issue, if there's any red flags on iodine, we have them go to a physician and check it out. And sometimes their doctor will say, great, have all the iodine you want.
Good.
You're hypo, right? You need more iodine. And other times we have to switch to a different disinfection method because their physician says, nah, you shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So this wasn't my idea. I picked it up using tincture of iodine 2% from a college here in Prescott that's been doing outdoor programs for 50 years.
Yes.
And they buy it by the gallon. So because you brought it up, let's not just turn over the rock and walk away.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're...
You go with this, Cody.
If your listeners are into that, we talked about the three contraindications about mm-hmm. not using. Tincture of iodine 2% is usually in a little one-ounce bottle. It'll be at some of the bigger drugstores, et cetera. It's a wound disinfectant. Yes, mm-hmm. you'll see a little skull and crossbones on it. Just we'll talk about that. Ignore that. Iodine was used to disinfect water before chlorine, actually, back in the day.
Wow.
And the reason they probably stopped using that is you can't have a municipal water source disinfected with iodine with pregnant people in town. So you go to the drugstore, get it. Again, it's usually in a one-ounce bottle. I just leave it in the bottle. And I've had very good luck with that bottle not being disruptive in the field. You know, it's fine. It's sturdy. Inside that bottle, there's a little applicator.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an eyedropper, per se. You just use cohesion of the liquid. It's a little wand in there, a little plastic thing that you make the drop. So we have the tincture of iodine. I carry it in my survival kit. We use it with hundreds and hundreds of clients over the years. And how I would use that is I would take my 1-quart water bottle and fill it up. And there's an art to filling that up.
Yes.
Because the two things that iodine doesn't like are turbidity, which is a fancy word for pond scum, and mm-hmm. it doesn't like cold water. What the pond scum does is allow the pathogens to hide inside. And the temperature of the water, if it's too cold, it increases the time the iodine takes to work to destroy the waterborne pathogens.
Yes, sir.
So I have a water bottle. I fill it with water. You know, in Arizona, rarely too cold, but again, you can increase the contact time, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about. You can add 5 to 10 drops per U.S. quart of water. Where I go, I usually add 5 drops. In the riparian areas here in Arizona, we have river otter, we have beaver,
mm-hmm.
we have all sorts of things pooping in the water. We know there's a Giardia count. We know there's a high fecal content count because it's a wild riparian stream and things poop in the water. But I'll add 5 drops. Again, you can add up to 10. Let that water sit for 30 minutes. The medical books say 20 minutes,
mm-hmm.
but I just let it sit for 30 minutes. Then we'll typically loosen the lid on that water bottle, dribble a few droplets around the thread to excavate and evacuate any water that wasn't treated, and you should be good to go with that. Since we've opened this can of worms.
Yeah.
There's a product out there that's a tablet of iodine. Basically, it's just a dry form of iodine. I don't like them for a variety of reasons, but not that they don't work. Well, there's stories about that, too.
Yes.
But there's an additive called PA Plus in this particular brand. And what that is ascorbic acid. So ascorbic acid neutralizes iodine. It doesn't just take the taste away. It stops the halogen, which is what it called,
mm-hmm.
a chlorine will be another halogen. It stops the halogen from doing its killing of the pathogen. The reason I'm bringing that up is, you know, Joey might, you know, wow, this iodine taste really sucks. It's not that I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
The more you use it, the stronger the taste. If someone out in the field on a hunting trip takes that pack of Kool-Aid with sugar or takes some Gatorade or adds some sort of powdered crystals to that water that have ascorbic acid or vitamin C in it before that contact time, they're essentially drinking non-treated water.
Yeah, they're in trouble.
So they're potentially in trouble. If you add a flavored whatever, if you're into flavoring, I'm not out here because you have to wait for that contact time and you should be good to go. And the cool thing about tincture of iodine, if you pass passed the test of the three contraindications of when not to use it, is that it's also clearly a wound treatment.
Mm-hmm.
My skin, when I was a kid, now it's Betadine, right? The trade name for povidone-iodine 10%. It's different, obviously, than the tincture. Tinctures have alcohol, so they sting like hell. So when you put the tincture of iodine on a cut, like my mom used to do on my cuts, I would scream
mm-hmm.
because it hurts to put alcohol in an open wound.
But
what I'm getting at is in a survival kit or a hunting pack, when you guys and gals are trying to condense gear, right? Because
mm-hmm.
you want to be able to follow that animal. You don't want to carry 90 pounds of crap on your back if you don't have to.
Yeah, I agree.
That tincture of iodine, in the context we described, you can treat a wound with it and you can treat your water with it, and all for less than $2 for 1 ounce.
Great information, Cody. Great information. Let's talk about some of your fire-making skills. This gentleman here can make fire from nothing. Let's talk about some of your methods.
Sure. Do you want to swing modern or primitive?
Let's go primitive. One thing that I like about primitive, when you're in a survival situation, and I hate to say this, sometimes people just aren't prepared. It's unexpected. It's going to come out of nowhere. You find yourself stuck, or let's say it's getting dark. You've lost your matches along the trail. What are you going to do?
The first thing I would do is carry three different ways to make fire on three different areas of your person. If you're in a wilderness situation having to make fire with sticks for real, you really screwed up. Because as an example, I have several ways to make fire in my survival kit. I have another way to make fire strapped around my knife, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that stuff happens. So back to your question, if you're in that situation wherever and don't have any modern ways to light fire, you're probably in for a long, cold night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's no mincing word. The easiest, and I use that term very, very loosely, clearly to make an apparatus to make fire, you're actually making a wooden apparatus to generate enough heat. I think it's around 800 to 900 degrees per an ember to then blow into flame is a hell of a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
It takes dedication, and any variable will screw you up.
Yes.
Bad materials, bad weather, too tired, too many blisters, got a cramp, whatever that is, there's a lot of variables. So to be very clear, because you're doing a show on survival skills, do not expect to go in the wilderness and just snap your fingers like a bullshit TV show and make fire with sticks. That's a gene pool waiting to happen for you and your family. But and the easiest way to make fire is ironically one of the harder ways to make it. What I mean by that is if you take a handle, for instance,
mm-hmm.
you have two parts. You have the spindle or drill or the fireboard or heart. In a bow drill, you have the spindle or drill, the fireboard or heart, plus the socket for downward pressure, plus the bow for speed, because downward pressure and speed are your friend.
Mm-hmm.
With this rotational method, okay, there's a fire piston, there's a compression method of making primitive fire, there's lateral methods of making primitive fire, like fire plow,
mm-hmm.
and there's rotational methods for making fire by friction, like hand drill, bow drill, pump drill, stuff like that. Making fire with the plow has two parts. You have the stick you're moving laterally back and forth with the heart. I'm assuming there's no knife involved, too, because we do a course called a nothing course where we don't have any steel knife with no gear.
Yes.
And when the tribe, because it's up to them, decides to make fire, the first thing they need to do is make stone tools to make the damn fire kit.
Yeah.
Which people always forget.
Let me interject something real quick, Cody. This area, there were a lot of Native Americans here years ago. Ouachita is actually an Indian word, and it means good hunting and fishing. We've got a lot of quartz here, a lot of crystal, some rocks that are perfect for making these types of implements. So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, and you know, we got a lot of rocks out here, too, in Arizona. We're
mm-hmm.
the rock capital. There's a ton of stuff, and there's a lot of Native activity still here. They have to make the set. And so if you've ever tried to make a fire-making set with stone tools, the easiest way to do that is to have less moving parts,
mm-hmm.
right? So that brings you a handle or something like that. The irony of that is those other moving parts, like the socket or like the bow in a bow drill,
mm-hmm.
quote-unquote, makes fire-making, quote-unquote, easier, whatever
yes.
the hell that word means, if you've ever you know, done this. So what I'm getting at is, in the fantasy of let's just go make fire with sticks because we watched this TV show, that you need to do that, and if you don't have any tools, it takes a lot of time and effort, and you'd always make the set with the least parts to make with your stone knives, which means probably that fire-making method is going to be one of the harder ones to do.
Yes.
Because you have to do more stuff manually. Like in a hand drill, you have to be the socket by pushing down, and you have to be the bow by rotating the spindle with your hand to make downward pressure and speed.
Yes.
So, I'll just say it. Shit happened. But we're talking about survival skills, and I understand stuff happens.
Yes.
But I really quantify it for people who think they know or just wanting more information. It's a rare bird who can go out in the wilderness, all things given, and make a fire with sticks with indigenous materials out there on the fly. Because that's not what native people did.
Yes.
Native people just didn't go on a hunting trip. Well, I think we'll make a bow drill or something. They brought it with them.
Absolutely.
That was their equivalent of matches.
Yeah.
And I realized that fear can be lost. That's one of the reasons my school is not fear-centric.
Yes.
Our whole motto is the more you know, the less you need.
Yes.
Because I don't want my students complacent, and I don't want them reliant on gear that they don't need, because that's a fatal flaw.
Yes.
In any sort of survival training, because like you're saying, one of the first questions that we're talking about is, what if I don't have this?
Yes.
So you have a survival instructor that's gear-centric, that likes to promote their stuff and make money off their students by selling them crap they don't need.
Yeah.
We call that camping in Arizona. That's not survival training. That's called camping.
Yes.
Because if you think about any survival situation that you can think of, is always a survival situation because of a lack of resources,
yes.
Period. That's what's causing potential death. In food, it's starvation.
Yeah.
In cold weather, it's hypothermia. In hot weather, you know, there's too much heat. It's hyperthermia.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have enough cooling effects. So if you think about survival training and its basic element of a lack of resources, it would make sense to go to a survival school that trains you with a lack of resources,
yes.
Period. And we're really, really big on that at my school, because it's the truth about what screws people out in the wilderness and what gets a lot of people killed is, even if they're, and I know you know this because of your law enforcement and your military experience, when you have someone that's become complacent mentally and emotionally on having that gear, and then they don't have that gear, they have a double whammy of, crap, I don't physically have my gear to do X, Y, and Z, and then mentally, they've never really thought about not having that gear, right? And so it's actually a block. It's that mental block. It's that it'll never happen to me. It's very popular in the outdoor world. Those survival situations, they happen to other people. And when you have that sort of attitude in the backcountry, that's very, very dangerous.
It is. I agree. And these skills will save your life, ladies and gentlemen. Next question, food. What is one of your favorite primitive ways for gathering food?
We'll sprinkle some context on your menu here.
All right, absolutely.
Food is way down on the list of modern survival training.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it, but I just want to be clear with your listeners that thermoregulation, hypothermia, and dehydration are the big killers.
Those are number one. Okay? Absolutely, I agree.
So you're on a hunt, and you're leaving a 5W game plan, where you are, who's in your party, etc., which you should do if you're on a hunt. The usual statistical search and rescue about when they find someone is within a 72-hour window, usually maybe that first day. It's called a hasty search in Yavapai County here. Well, they usually find most lost peoples within 8 hours or less. Now, there's a lot of variables to what I just said.
Yes.
But typically, we can all, especially after Thanksgiving, God help me, we're still eating leftovers. You know, I can definitely go 3 days without eating, especially after Thanksgiving, because I've eaten for three people over the last, 2 days. So back to what is my favorite method to acquire food in the backcountry, that depends on where I am, what I'm doing. Is it aquatics? Is it on the land? Can you narrow that down a little bit to a bioregion?
Yeah.
That question?
Yeah. Here's a good example. I interviewed somebody last week, and they were stranded in British Columbia for a couple of weeks. Bush pilot dropped them off and never came back. You know, he had some gear, but I guarantee you he did a little hunting too, like primitive methods. methods. I know that you attend or that you've gone to a meeting called Rabbit Stick up in Idaho. I know using a rabbit stick, something as simple as a throwing stick, is a good way to put small game in the pot. What's one of your favorite methods? So that's what I meant.
We'll stay primitive then. We've had very little success with a rabbit stick just because we suck. You know, when you take a bunch of people out in the woods that have never thrown a stick before, one, it's like it's the typical thing where you're taking a dump and the rifle's leaning against the tree and the deer walks by.
Uh-huh.
So typically, it's like whenever someone picks up a rabbit stick and goes hunting, they don't see any rabbits.
Yeah.
Now, keep in mind, you can do other things in Arizona for small game with that. But
sure.
I am a fan. It is illegal for us to do certain things in Arizona with trapping, and I'm talking primitive traps here. But as far as the simplicity of design of a deadfall trap, I like deadfall traps a lot because of a couple main reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The one I'm going to tell you about is a tight deadfall, and you're probably familiar with that. It does take cordage.
Yes.
With the cordage, it's a beauty in that. So that's the extra thing you need to factor in. But I'm a fan of deadfall traps because they tend to kill outright,
mm-hmm.
and they tend to trap your food then under a rock that is not moved by another animal.
Yes.
If you get something in a snare and that animal starts to make noise, something else is going to get your animal, period. They'll bring in every coyote from, you know, a mile radius.
You got a lot of them in the desert, I know that. I saw my share in West Texas, and we got a lot of them here.
And the other thing is, I don't take killing anything lightly.
Yeah.
So I'd rather, if you were going to kill me, Steve, I'd want you to just, we can do it. Just do it outright. Don't torture me. Don't hang me by my neck with a willow sapling that is green that doesn't have enough twitch to break my neck or whatever the fiasco is. Deadfalls typically kill quick. They kill outright. They stop the noise. They keep the predators away, potentially to take my dinner or my lunch or whatever. I like the Paiute deadfall.
Mm-hmm.
There's two sticks and a piece of string. Whatever rock, there's one in my second book, When Alcohol Breaks Loose, where I use pencils and dental floss and a book for killing rodents or whatever.
Excellent.
It's hard to go out and put a bunch of stuff up as a bunch of greenhorns and expect to pay off.
Yeah.
Yes, we do kill stuff with that stuff in the field, but every time, absolutely not.
Yes.
I mean, you know from being a hunter, do you get a deer every time you go out? Probably not. That's not Steve's fault. I mean, that you can't kill what's not there. So that trap has probably put more bacon on the fire, so to speak, than anything we've done short of just hand fishing. I have a permit from Game and Fish from my college courses to hand fish when the fish population was higher.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my God, you can...
You were the only person licensed in the state of Arizona to fish with your bare hands. That's...
I think I still am.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's amazing.
So, well, the reason that hand fishing is illegal in Arizona is because it can be so effective.
Yes.
If you're in the right area. But the Paiute deadfall, really, the reality of having students that are beginning and primitive skills out in the field, and even myself trying to do all this at once, and game laws, obviously, and rules and regulations of the 21st century, is we're going after a lot of rodents.
Yes.
You know, we're going after mice, we're going after pack rats, maybe some rock squirrels. One, I'm not going to violate and break the law, you know, the Game and Fish rules. We're not going to, like, be going after mule deer in my courses because that's illegal. If you look at trapping historically, yes, they trapped all sorts of stuff, and people hunted all sorts of stuff to eat, but the little guys keeping the village alive until they bring down the big guy. A lot of mice and rats, rabbits, and certain things like that were trapped until we finally brought down the mule deer as a village, you know.
Makes perfect
sense. I don't think rodents should be discounted. One, because, again, they're legal for what I do.
Yeah.
They're easier for a beginning student to kill. They do have a lot of caloric value.
Yes.
The other thing, which is off topic of what we're talking about so far, but it's not in my world, is I also teach urban preparedness, so without the zombie.
Excellent.
And one of the reasons that I put the Paiute deadfall trap in When All Hell Breaks Loose, my second book, was there's nothing that'll screw up your survival storage food quicker than rats in the garage or mice in the pantry.
I agree,
so
yeah.
I wanted people to have an alternative way if they didn't have any Victor mouse traps. I'm a big fan of Victor mouse traps and rat traps, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
To kill those rodents, not necessarily for consumption, at least not yet in our urban preparedness scenario, but to try to save your family's food supply from being polluted and decimated by rodents.
That's a two-pronged strategy, and that makes a lot of sense. In fact, that's very wise. Let's touch on disease, because I know someone listening, they're going to think, well, you know, rats and mice, they're diseased.
Well, they can be. You're talking to me in Arizona, and we have black plague still here,
mm-hmm.
the black death, and we have hantavirus. And so do you.
Yes.
If you look at a hantavirus map, it's in all lower 48 states. We had that big outbreak in the Four Corners region,
mm-hmm.
About 20 years ago or so, and that kind of put hantavirus on the map. And of course, it's a virus, like the name implies.
Yes.
And what's scary about hantavirus is it's a viral infection that causes your lungs to fill up with fluid and you die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no cure for it, by the way. It's interesting we're talking about this during the era of COVID-19.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Which is also a respiratory problem.
Mm-hmm.
But hantavirus, there's no known cure. I guess there's a 50% survival rate, which is scary as hell when you really think about that. And how that spread is airborne. So it's inhaled, just like COVID, droplets of certain rodent saliva or feces or urine.
Mm-hmm.
When that dries and gets airborne, like let's say we used to back in the day, Steve, it was protocol to rip apart pack rat nests on survival courses and steal the pack rat's tinder for fire making, to steal their food, and to eat them and their family. No one does that anymore.
Yeah.
Because to disturb or decimate a pack rat nest is inviting hantavirus potential all over your face and all over your students, which is, you know, extremely deadly and bad. So to put it in context, even though we have black plague here in Arizona still, mm-hmm. and we have hantavirus, when you think about the rodent coming to your deadfall trap to then hopefully be killed so you can eat it,
mm-hmm.
we're assuming that animal is healthy because it's hunting and foraging. Sick animals don't look around for food. Sick animals are sick.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than if we have the flu, we want to go to a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, obviously you'd want to identify that, you know, let's stick with rodents because,
yes.
you know, you lift the deadfall, you have something, it's a mouse or a rat or a rock squirrel or whatever, and then you can pretty much look around that animal. And for mice, we do eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
We take out the stomach and the lower intestine and the anus and just take that out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to eat mouse crap.
Yeah.
But we'll eat everything else. And so while we're kind of in there doing that, eviscerating that animal, leaving the lungs, leaving the heart, whatever, and then we just roast them over open coals in the fire, right on the coals. You can kind of see other stuff that's going on, see if that animal looks healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is the risk out there, obviously, when you're dealing with anything
sure.
wild.
Oh, even deer with chronic wasting disease. You know, one thing I've seen, Cody, and I just cringe, and this is even on some of the survival programs, I've seen some of the people cook things, I mean, improperly. You know, some of them are eating raw, which some things you can ingest raw.
Anyone who would take survival advice off a television program, that's a gene pool thing waiting to happen.
Sure,
you know, right?
Sure, yeah.
But yes, you know as a hunter that you know how to prepare stuff. I know a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
But if you look at a mouse as a very small version of a deer,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of the things are the same. This doesn't look right. This doesn't smell right. But when an animal is actively hunting and it comes to you in a baited deadfall trap, then that's automatically a thumbs up. And then we just inspect it from there.
Great advice, Cody. That's how I learned, ladies and gentlemen. I learned how to skin deer by starting off with small game like rabbits and squirrels. We're kind of running out of time. Before we close, I'd like you to direct people to your website, to your books, and to your school where they could find more information. So could you please do that?
My school is called the Aboriginal Living Skills School. Aboriginal Living Skills School. We're celebrating our 30th year in business for 2021, and we have courses out now for 2021. And the website address is www.codylundin.com. That's spelled CODYLUNDIN. My first book, which I hope you like, off Amazon, is 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive. The focus of that book is hypohyperthermia dehydration in the context of what I like in a desert and mountain survival kit.
Okay.
So a lot of physiology, a lot of physics, a lot of science in the book. And then the last half is what I choose to carry in a wilderness survival kit for desert and mountain regions. And my second book is When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes. And that's quite a big book, 450 pages. It's perfect for COVID, and the sales have been spiking because of COVID-19. It's like, what happens if the grid bursts? What do we really need all this toilet paper? There's a chapter on sanitation, hygiene, communications, etc. So it's the more practical for most of us who live in an urban area. What would happen if my power went out? You know, if there was a hurricane or an earthquake?
Yes, sir.
Or or COVID-19, et cetera. So that's more urban preparedness, but they're very, very different contexts.
Yes, sir. Well, Cody, I sure enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, well, thank you, and you all stay safe, okay?
Yes, sir. You too. This is Steve Stillwell. I hope you enjoyed today's show with Cody Lundeen. I was really impressed. Not only is he very intelligent, he's gracious, and I'll say this, he is rock solid tough. I've seen him survive in some very harsh environments. Thanks again for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show.